Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is a show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. So today I'm getting back to a fantasy series that I'm reading through for the second time. I read it first back in 2008 and 2009, as Goodreads is telling me here, and I'm going back through it because I didn't actually review these first two books on the podcast because it was before I started reviewing fantasy books on the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. Now I just include everything, even though I did read that series at the same time as doing this podcast. And the series is the Prince of Nothing series by R. Scott Bakker. And a few episodes ago, I reviewed the first book in the series, which is called The Prince of Nothing. No, it's not. It's called The Darkness That Comes Before. And then the second book is called The Warrior Prophet, and that's the one I'm going to review today. However, this is the second book in a series of books, and it's about a series that I've talked about before, and with characters from the last episode, or two episodes ago when I was talking about this first book. So I'm not going to get into too much details about the characters, except maybe one or two of them, or the situation, because and there might be some spoilers from the previous book, but I'll just talk about it in general terms and why I enjoy this series of books, or enjoy this specific book, because to be honest, I've started listening to the next book, the third book in this first trilogy, and last time I was thinking, okay, the first book is like a 4-star book, the second book, which is what I'm reviewing now, probably about 4.5 stars, because it is better than the previous one, and then the third book really drops off. So overall, it kind of brings it down. It's an okay end to the story, but as a unit of entertainment, as a book, it just doesn't work so much at all. Of course, I'll mention that more in the next episode that I do, wrapping up that book, because I was thinking when I start this, I'd probably just read the first two because I enjoyed them and not read the second one, but I thought, or the third one. I thought, okay, I'll just go straight through to the third one. So here we go, second book. And this is one of those rare cases where the second book in a trilogy is better than the first. And I couldn't actually off the top of my head think about any, if there's a trilogy and there's three books in the trilogy, sometimes, you know, like with the culture, you'll read the first book, like Consider Phlebas, it's not very good, the second book, but it's not a continuation of the same story, it's just set in the same world, and that happens quite often. But with a trilogy of books, when does the second one in a planned out 3-part story become better than the first? But I could think of a few examples in the movie world. One of course is Star Wars. I think Empire Strikes Back is the better movie, but it's dependent on the first movie existing for it to be better, because it comes straight in, there's characters you already know, characters you already care about, and the adventure can kick straight into gear, and even though the characters aren't together for a lot of that, you know, they get separated out, they've got enough of a history together, and kind of an alluded history together, you know, because the Empire Strikes Back is like set like 2 years later or whatever it is, and they're like, oh, okay, all this time they've been struggling and having adventures together, and you carry on, and you're like, okay, that's, you know, the better second movie depends on the first one. I think the same thing happened with The Hunger Games. I quite enjoyed the first Hunger Games movie. I'd read the book. I hadn't read the second book, but I watched the second movie, and I was like, actually, this is a better movie than the first, but again, it only works because the rules have already been set up in the first book, or in the first movie, or book, I guess, in that case. I'm not sure about if the second book is better than the first book, but for the movie, it works that way. And that's the same thing that happens here with The Warrior Prophet. It starts off, and it just kicks straight into gear. It's like, and now they're off, and stuff is happening straight away. In the first book, it's kind of dependent on that first book, you know, because the characters are just there. They've already been set up. A lot of the first book is, okay, let's get these characters. Who are they? And now they're in place. And let's go. And as it goes, let's go. Let's set this war off. Let's set this crusade off. And then just the book ends. And you're like, okay, that's really set it well for the next book. And it does pay off pretty well in this novel. So it's the end of the first book. They get together all the armies at a place called, I'm going to bring up the map here because I have it here, and the map of the Western Three Seas on the planet, or the world of Irwa. And so they get all together, all the armies together in Moman, and armies from all the way around the Three Seas. And the analogy is, of course, like all the way around the Mediterranean, or across like Northern Europe and Western Europe, there was lots of Christian nations, and they go, okay, we're going to go down to the birthplace of Sejanus, In Re Sejanus, that's in the book, of course, that's kind of a Jesus, the latter prophet or the second prophet or whatever it works out as. And they go, okay, the heathen, the Kianese in the book, which is kind of like the Muslims, the Islamic or the you know, the Arabs or whatever it is in this analogy, it's okay, we're going to go and liberate and take back Jerusalem or take back Bethlehem, and they gather all the armies together here in Momem, kind of like Constantinople, and get all the armies, and now we're going to head off down south and take back Shima, and so that's the city that they're going to, and there's lots of things along the way. However, that's a really great way of setting it up, but the kind of journey that this they go on, they go down to Gedea, and then to Shigek, and Shigek is kind of like the Nile, because it's like there's a desert on one side, and there's this massive river that comes down through it, and it floods out this delta, and there's a battle, and there's lots of, you know, civilization there, and you think, okay, this is really ancient, and there's a library there, kind of like a Library of Alexandria, but kind of maybe not the Library of Alexandria, and there's all these different things in Shigek, and there's some battles there, and then they go off across the desert, and they get down to Karasand, and that's like a big a walled city, and that's where all the action happens. And that's what kind of, that's the route that they take. When you look on the map, it goes, oh, they go from there to there to there. How hard can that be? Turns out really, really hard. And what this brings to mind, and this is what I really like about this series, is that the logistics of war is the deciding factor. And this happens in other science fiction books, of course, but in other fantasy books, but that is what the book is about. The pitched battles are... okay, they're interesting. There's some strategy there. There's some tactics. You see the way they planned out. But that's not, you know, there's only parts of the book. There's only like a chapter here or a chapter there where the battle's happening. The characters are developing all the way through. But the actual journey of the Holy War, as it's called, is, again, the analogy that always came to mind with this is the French, the Napoleonic invasion of Russia, and I brought up the Wikipedia page just so I can get some correct numbers, of 1812. And they, Napoleonic, they got together, it says here there was the French Empire, and there was some, you know, the Germanic, there's Baden, Bavaria, Berg, Saxony, these other people, there's some Swiss people, some Austrians, some Prussians, some Denmark, Norway people, all get together and was like, right, let's go through Poland and then set off and invade Russia. And the numbers are just astounding. The Grand Army, the Grande Army, I'm not quite sure how you pronounce that, anyway, numbering 68,000, including 680,000, including 300,000 French departments, of the French departments. So they go across, and they're going to go across Russia. And of course, the Russians just keep falling back and falling back and falling back all the way to Moscow. And when they get to Moscow, they're like, yay, we're in Moscow. Oh shit, where are the Russians? I wanted to do a treaty here and that kind of stuff. And so you get this kind of stuff going on, and then they're like, oh shit, the winter's coming, right, let's get back. And it says the Grand Army lost some 380,000 died, 100,000 captured, lots of them left, and so when it actually crossed back again, there was like 4,000 of the soldiers who actually got to Moscow managed to make it back, plus some other people who had gone off in, like, some other army parts that had gone off in a different direction. There's this famous graph which shows, let me actually look here on this, also on Wikipedia. Charles Joseph Minard's famous graph showing the decreasing size of the Grand Army as it marches to Moscow, the brown line from left to right, and back, the black line from right to left, with the size of the army equal to the width of the line. Just look on the Wikipedia page for this. This is absolutely amazing. 680,000 people go in one direction, 4,000 people return. So you just look at that and go, that's actually a thing that happened. There was that many people who died along in this military conquest, you know, and then of course the losses on the other side, thinking probably around about 1 million people died in this war. Now, that 1 million people dying in a war, that's what you think of, like, you know, like the, you know, like that's kind of like First World War, Second World War numbers. Of course, it's a lot more than that, but in the Second World War especially. But this is a big chunk of the fighting forces of France and everything going across. and dying along the way. And one of the main things that were killing them was, of course, the supply lines, was that they were going into Russia and the armies needed feeding, and they were just dying of starvation all the way. They weren't dying of battles. There were some battles along the way. Lots of people did die in battles. But when you see those people heading back from Moscow, 100,000 people set off, and you're like, right, okay, so what's going to kill them? Okay, some of the armies are going to kill them, but then they get to this river, and you just see on this graph, they reach a river, and then like half of the army dies crossing this river. And then you look at the graph at the bottom of how low the temperature was getting, like minus 37.5 degrees Celsius. That's almost minus 40 degrees, which is minus in Fahrenheit and in Celsius. It's still minus 40. And this is what the army was going through trying to get there. 680,000 people set off. 4,000 or, you know, 20,000, depending on where you're actually counting or something, manage to make it back again. Now, a lot of those didn't die. A lot of them were captured. A lot of them deserted. But that is still very impressive. Now, bringing it back to the Prince of Nothing series and this second book, The Warrior Prophet, what we have is that going on, kind of. And again, I don't want to give too much away, but like, okay, crossing this river, how many people? How many people die in battle? The amount of people who die in battle, it diminishes. I mean, like the scale of numbers of people who die in battles compared to just die because of bad logistics and like not getting enough food, not getting enough water, and then there's a plague. And I don't want to get too much into it because there's this, you know, this is what the story is. It is a story of the Holy War and the shrinking of the Holy War. First of all, they're like, okay, well, if we don't have enough water or food, who dies first? And they call it the shrinking or the refining of the Holy War, as, you know, as the things are going down. And this is one of the things that I enjoy so much about this book, that the army, the Holy War itself, is a character. It's not very often you actually see this. You go, oh, well, an army is an army. Who's in the army? Well, actually, the humans are the most important thing about, you know, in a work of fiction. But the character of the army is the thing that is most impressive, and how it changes over time, the spirit of the people. And that's what this book is about. It's about the rise of like a new cult within the Holy War, the armies of the Holy War, and the tribulations that they go through. Is like, are we being purified? Are we being defeated? And it's just the way that they look at it. And it's said that, you know, like 400,000 people start off going or gather together for the Holy War. That's I think that's the kind of numbers. In a way, I want to draw one of the, or maybe someone's already done it actually, draw this graph again of this of the Minard. Is it Minard? I forgot the name again. This Charles Joseph Minard's famous graph. You know, it would be really good to actually do one of those kind of things with the Holy War in the Prince of Nothing series. Okay, here, this many people set off here. These group of people went over there. These people went here. And then they got through the desert. How many people went to the desert? How many people came out of the desert? And again, I don't want to get into the spoilers, but those scenes of the army going through the desert are some of the most memorable scenes that I've read in fiction. I'm not even sure that the writing is all that good, and sometimes it feels a bit repetitive, and the way that they're talking about it, it's, you know, it's not always amazing writing, but just it captures the feeling, it captures the vibe, it captures like what it feels like, you know. Even though it's sometimes it's not in depth, it's just like, and then they came here, and then thousands died along the way. And it keeps saying, oh, and thousands died trying to get through here, and then thousands died. And you're like, well, how many thousands were there? And then after you keep going, oh, and thousands died here, and thousands died there, and then the people were poisoned, and thousands died. Well, how many thousands? And then actually, you know, once the army comes through the tribulation, it actually says, okay, this many people entered the desert, this many people came out of the desert. And you're like, holy shit, that doesn't sound right. It sounds like it's one of those things where you just go, that can't be right. It doesn't sound right. This is not the kind of thing that you normally read about in fiction or in fantasy. The people, you know, the army gets where it wants to go, and then they have a big fight, and that's where the story happens. Here, the story happens between the battles. The character of the army changes more in its getting from A to B than it does in, oh, and now we defeat the enemy, and now we don't defeat the enemy, and things like that. So that whole situation is amazing. And there's this really great part. Again, this I think it must have something to do with this 1812 invasion of Russia. When they get to Moscow, and they turn up and go, oh, where is everyone? You know, that kind of thing. Here in the book, there's something slightly different, and it's one of those fantastic moments which really stays with me, that they go around and they like, oh, they surround this city, and they're running down the city. It's a siege. There's no food left in the city, and they're going, right, we'll get in there. We'll get in there. We'll get in there. We've got all of enough food. They're being supplied and things like that. We'll get in there with the holy war. Yeah, we're going to get into Karak-San. Get into Karak-San. Finally, not going to give it away, but they get into Karak-San, and then another army turns up and just immediately lays siege to them, and they're like, oh shit, there's no food in this city, and now we're... And it's just one of those fantastic things where you just go, oh, in the... What is it? From the jaws of victory, we snatch defeat. It's one of those moments which is just... I think it's just really, really great, and really sticks with me. First from the first time I've read this onto the second time. Okay, let's move on to some of the some of the characters. One of the things that I mentioned here in my notes, which aren't so much notes but in my reading progress here on goodreads.com. You should become my friend on Goodreads. You can see what I'm saying about this. I put down at the start, I said, I'm really enjoying the what came before section, because one of the main themes in this is, like, you know thyself, and, you know, what comes before, what thoughts come before, say what, like, shows what comes after, what happens before, you know, it's all the cause and effect kind of thing. And there's a great section, like, it's just a chapter length saying what came before, and it kind of wraps up the previous book, the darkness that comes before. It wraps that into just a chapter, just goes back over it, but it doesn't say this happened, then this happened. It tells it from the point of view of each individual character, like, okay, Mathanet was here, he said this, and they gathered together what, okay, this character was over here and he did that, and then as it goes through it kind of goes, oh, and this character was here, and then she did that, and then she did that, and then, and this character was here, and then he did that, and he did that, and the last character, it comes to Kellis, and it's like, Kellis did this, and even though his bit of the what comes before section is the last section, or you know, is the last passage in there, you realize that actually he is coming before all of that, and it kind of hints at what is actually going on and the real picture as it goes through, and say, and now the same story from this person's point of view, and now the same story from this person's point of view. As you get those things, you can actually go, oh, now we're actually starting to get to see some of the cause and effect of this book. Which brings me to Kellis, and my next note was, this is way more hardcore Kellis is awesome material up front than I remember. I guess that'll pass once the army sets off into the desert, and that is true. But there is a very much like a Kellis is also Kellis. Let me just get his full correct name here. Yeah, the Anasarimbor Kellis is a mysterious Dunyane warrior whose powers over those around him brings him into control of the Holy War and its people. And that's what happens. He because he can know other people so well, and he comes before them, and he's a very manipulative person. I say he's a very manipulative person is probably the greatest understatement of this entire series. He's more than just a manipulative person. That is his essence, is manipulation, and say the whole idea of coming before someone and changing them in ways and speaking to them, speaking truth to them in a way that can undermine them, undermine everything about them, undermine their authority and all that kind of stuff. So he's there, and he slowly builds up a following and starts taking over the whole of the Holy War. It is terrifying to see him work. The way that he does stuff, it's like, again, I made this thing here, he's really creepy, but he's one of those people where you're like, oh, I want him to, like, he's evil and I want him to fail, but he's also like a really good villain, but also he is in another way as a hero, he's a protagonist, and you're like, well, who is he actually going to be fighting against, like, who is going to be his match? And at some points you see people who could be his match and other ways, and it's again, it's one of those things where you've got to read. Now, I understand that sometimes the writing doesn't really do it justice. How is he such a superhero? Like, how does he have this power over people? But in some ways, it feels a bit weak. That it's just like, oh, and then he says this. And you're like, well, how does he know that? But again, it's one of those things that when someone is beyond you, it's difficult to kind of portray, like, it's almost supernatural in a way. It's that kind of magical thing. It's like, and sometimes he doesn't understand what's going on, and he'll make these plays. He goes into the probability trance where he sits down, closes his eyes, and tries to work through all the probabilities of everything in his head. Is he using Bayesian reasoning or whatever? You know, like, how is he doing all of that? But he comes out and makes a plan and goes with it. But It's really freaky. However, it does sometimes bring down some, like, it kind of shows off in other ways how well it's written, because he will sit there and he will say, okay, this person over there is looking at that person. He keeps making eye contact with that person. He's saying this and this expression in his face. And it's like you're reading something in the, like, in a third person narrator, kind of like, but like an omniscience of everything, but kind of explaining the scene. So it's like a movie, instead of reading a movie script, it's reading a movie treatment. Like, it's going, okay, now we see this person and their motivation is this, and they are thinking that, and this person over here is thinking this, and this person, they're sitting around a fire, but this person is, instead of just talking to the people next to him, he's shouting across the fire to talk to people opposite him. And in that way, he is showing his dominance. He's trying to, like, raise his status with everybody else, and this person doesn't know what's happening, but this other person can see it happening. And it's interesting to see it from Kellis's point of view, because you realize, this is the kind of thought that authors have to put into their writing, or should be putting into the writing, when they're actually writing a scene. Okay, there's people sitting around a fire. And if you have someone continuously calling across the fire and interrupting other people or shouting at other people, it's like, okay, that would be good writing, instead of just saying this person is dominant because A, B, C, D, E, and F. It's like, just show A, B, C, D, and F, and kind of the people can determine the dominance of that person themselves. Like, it just infer it from the writing, or even subconsciously they don't realize it, but then when that person is in charge 5 chapters later, you're like, oh yeah, of course he was, because, you know, well, not of course he is, but it all comes together. And it's interesting to see the writing from the point of view of the omniscience, kind of like knowing the motivations of everyone, but actually via a character. Because then when it's not from his point of view and you actually see these scenes and you see people talking, you realize that same stuff is still happening in those scenes, but it's not being explained in that way, but you can still see it. So it kind of brings attention in some ways to the good writing, but also in some ways to some of the writing where you go, well, it doesn't actually make all of that much sense. So it becomes like an interesting reading experience, even when you're not seeing it from Kellis's point of view. He isn't quite human, I must admit. He's a bit weird, and some of the stuff that happens at the end is like, what did he do with his heart? I'm not entirely sure. But then I'm just listening to the next audiobook, and people are going, what did he do with his heart? I'm not quite sure there either. The other characters, the people that Kellis interacts with, I really like Confus. Akiri Confus is good. Nair is the barbarian, the Skilvendi barbarian. It remains one of my favorite characters, just because he's so crazy, and then he's the only one who sees through Kellis, and yet he still can't do as much about it as he wants to, even though Kellis is like, this guy, he's the only one who knows what my powers are, really, and the real secrets. But that's interesting. Which brings me, of course, to one of the main characters in the next books, and I guess in this book, which is Esmenet, which I'm going to go for the that pronunciation this time. Esmenet, the stuff that I didn't see in the first time I read the first book, and I was like, now I understand it, that she is actually bigger, she is more capable, but Achaemenid doesn't see her as she is and how great she could be. And it's like, well, they shouldn't, like, why, she's actually too good for him, even though, it says here on Wikipedia, is a horror of the Sumner, of the city of Sumner. She's the horror of Sumner. And he's like a really powerful sorcerer. It's like, actually, she's the one who is too good for him rather than the other way around. And it kind of plays out in this book in a way which, second time through, is way, way clearer, especially because I know what happens in the following books, of course, in the next series too. Sirway is quite tragic. Who else is here? And Drusus Achaemenid himself. Again, some of my favorite scenes is him in the library when he gets captured by his enemies. And again, don't want to give too much away, but if you're going to be writing magic and you're going to be talking about magic fights, this is what I want to see. You know, like, just throw it all out there, but still make it so you understand the power differences, you understand the limits of their power, and when other power comes in, you're like, actually, these people probably be pretty well matched. And even it says in these other books, it's like, if I have this power, not in this book, but in the later books in the series, like, okay, if this power and this power comes up, you know, who would be the most powerful? But the way it's kind of set out and the way it describes it, you're like, yeah, I reckon this, and it, you know, just by... But this is the first real magic battle that we've seen, like, close up, of, like, this person does this person does that. And the magic itself is kind of explained in a bit more depth. The idea that the anagogic schools, they do everything by analogy, Like, if they want to make fire, they've got to make a dragon, and that's going to spit fire. Whereas the Gnostic schools, the mandate, they just go, okay, we want fire. Actually, what is fire? It's just heat. Okay, we're just going to do heat. They kind of hack the rules of the universe to just do the things right from the basis of it. And that's kind of hinted at in the first book, and it's kind of, and now it's shown in this second book. In the third book, they actually kind of explain it a lot more. But that is, all that kind of stuff is really interesting. And yeah, some fantastic scenes there. And some of the things that, again, I missed in the first read through, I pick up on it. There's a thing with the paper doll, or the doll, like the kind of little doll thing. And you read it and you're like, oh, that's just a little thing here. And but of course, second time through, I'm like, oh shit, that's going to come back in later. I know what's going to happen. So I like the magic battles. I like the stuff with the logistics. Overall, I think this is a really fun book. Like I say, better than the first book. I could talk more about it, but it's weird because it's just a second book in the series. I'm like, yeah, more of this, please. Unfortunately, the third book in the series doesn't deliver more of this. It kind of just tails off a bit. But I just really enjoy reading about the army and the character of the army and the character of, you know, the rise of a cult within a religion and how someone takes over. And, you know, how intentional that is and how much they are in control of how much they want to take over. Of course, Kellis is wanting to take it over. That's his stated goal. He's like, I'm going to have to take control of the Holy War. And you're like, well, how is he going to do that? Is he going to take over the generals and swing them their way? Is he going to use his intellects? But no, using religion and using the cult, it is impressive. But then, again, it always comes down in these fantasy books. Like, if you live in a world where gods are real, where magic is real, where religion is real, where there is an afterlife, where there is demons, where you do have to be concerned about your eternal soul, you would be doing things... I mean, if there is real evidence that all of this supernatural exists, you would be aiming for being in a religion. You know, you would want to hedge your bets and go, right, I'm going to be in this religion. I'm going to go with the one that seems the most truthful for me. Unfortunately, or fortunately, or well, it's kind of neutral in our real world. If we go for the most true sounding religion, we'll probably all end up as kind of like very, very wishy-washy agnostics, pantheists, deists, or whatever you want to say in that way, because there is no evidence. But in a world where there is evidence, you're like, okay, which is the religion that most closely matches the way that our current understanding of the world and all the evidence that fits it? And you'll be like, yeah, we should actually sign up to this guy and his religion, or his version of this religion, or his cult within the religion, because it is the most truthful. And the leader isn't someone who we only read about by books who existed thousands of years ago. They're right here now with power. Why wouldn't we sign up for it? And it is one of those interesting quandaries that it's like, yeah, to write meaningful things about religion, well, not meaningful things, but to write interesting things about religion, you kind of got to use a fantasy world where religion is true, where the supernatural is real. I'm not saying you got to read that, but that's kind of interesting stuff that I enjoy reading in fantasy. So I think that's all I'm going to say about this. For me, it's a 4.5-star book. It is not for everyone. There is a lot of grimness. This book is probably, for me, the definition of the grimdark fantasy. It's really grim. There is a lot of death. There is a lot of murder. There is a lot of rape. There is a lot of stuff. Unfortunately, that kind of does reflect the real world of human history. And you can try and go, oh, well, you didn't want it to be that way, because it isn't. But yeah, just read about this war of 1812. No, not the war of 1812. That was an American war, wasn't it? Anyway, this invasion of Russia in 1812. And then you read about what was going on in those crusades and the way that, and, you know, in all these wars back then, you're just like, oh, okay. So they just killed everyone in the city, did they? Yeah. Everyone in the city just died. Yeah. And you're like, isn't that a bit extreme? It's like, but that's what happens. That's what happens. You know, reading about this even in... in the modern world with ISIS and all that kind of stuff, you just go, oh, so they're just going to completely destroy this and kill everyone who, like, someone is dancing, so they die. Yeah, you know, it's just, I don't know, just the whole thing is absolutely crazy that this kind of thing used to happen. The way that you're reading this book, this was the way that wars used to happen. And I'm so glad, we're so fortunate that we live in the modern world when we're, like, like in 6 months. I mean, I don't know how many people have died in Iraq and how many American soldiers and how many, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But you just look at the scale of what war used to be like, and what we have now since the Second World War is nothing. It's just nothing. Or maybe since the Vietnam. I don't even know what wars. I haven't looked up this kind of stuff. But the atrocities, modern day atrocities, are nothing. They're awful, but compared to the past, it's like we're talking like 1 or 2%, you know, like and here and there, and it's just so weird that you can actually read about this like in a fictionalized world, which makes it very immediate, in a way that some history books do well as well. But you know, in fiction, this is a great way of doing it, and it really brings it home that, you know, humans, because this is fantasy with aliens on a different world, we're in a secondary world. I say aliens, but you know. It's not the same world as we're in, but it brings it home in a way which is I find very interesting to read. So that's it from me. I do suggest that if you're going to read these, I read all these books first as paper books. This audio version is really good, though. Let me bring up the Audible page here. Yeah, the first book is 20 hours and 48 minutes. The second book is 23 hours. And the third book, also worth reading just to finish off with the story, even now I'm listening to it, I know it, I realize it's not as good as the first two books, 17 hours. This is actually a really, really good deal, so I'm going to do my Audible plug now, which is go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP, and in doing so, you can sign up for a free trial, and in doing that, you can you actually help support the SFBRP financially, which helps me. It was really nice, like I said, I think on the last episode, looking at my tax returns and actually see how much money came in over last year. It's really fantastic. It's a fantastic support for me also buying books and doing all of the hosting and all that kind of stuff. And actually, last year was the first time I broke even with the Science Fiction Book Review podcast. So yeah, it'll be really fantastic. If you want to help out, support the show, go to audibletrial.com/SFBAP, sign up for an audiobook, a free audiobook, and then a continuing subscription where it's like a monthly subscription, which is absolutely fantastic. I do suggest check out The Darkness That Comes Before, Prince of Nothing, Book 1. It's narrated by, let me click on it here, David DeVries. Absolutely fantastic. Some really, really good, really, really good character work. Really, really good, very, very evocative reading. He, the way that he does the battles, you know, he puts on a different voice when it goes into the third person, omniscient kind of battles, where it's suddenly like, oh, and then over here, this happened over here. You know, he really conjures it up in a way which is actually... again, I read this as a paper book the first time. It really brings it to life in a way that I didn't read it that way my first, and it's like a different take on it. So I do suggest, even if you've read a book before, listening to it as an audiobook is the best way for me of rereading a book that I like. Even a book that I don't like, rereading it via audiobook is still the best way of rereading, because somebody else is bringing their take on it, which doesn't interrupt yours, but or it doesn't get in the way of yours, but it kind of flavors it in a way which I find always fascinating and really enjoyable. So check out Audible, audibletrial.com/SFBRP. Thanks for the support. You can email me, luke@juggler.net. I do reply to every single email. You can follow me on Goodreads and become a friend there, and also become a member of the SFBRP listener group on Goodreads, where we're discussing this book and this series and lots of others as well. And follow me on Twitter. I think I've said that, at Luke Burridge on Twitter. And I guess that's about it. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.